everybody, and welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell. Ryan Bailey is not doing the introduction, which means I get to yell it. It's a snowy day here in Richmond after it was 66 degrees yesterday. I'm not sharing that information to tell you about the weather because no one cares about the weather, much like traffic and fantasy football stories. But I'm saying it's a strange day here, which sort of mirrors the strangeness of the weekend in the footballing world. Joining me to talk about the weekend that was are two gentlemen. Up first, a man who just spent time in Minnesota and is now back in Arizona. It's Joe Lowry. Joe, how strange of a switch was that to make?
It's really strange. Guys, it is really, really, really cold in Minnesota. And as Taylor said, I don't share that because anyone actually cares, but it is sort of relevant. And Taylor, we had a few people tweet this at us. With U.S. Men's national team games coming up in that part of the country, one in Minnesota specifically, I believe on January 27th, it's going to be freezing. Like, literally, it's going to be so, so, so cold. When you and I had that conversation before, Taylor, when those locations were announced, we said this could be an advantage, and it could be, but I am more skeptical than ever that putting games in St. Paul, Minnesota was ever a good idea. I think my bones are still thawing out, Taylor Rockwell.
Joe, I saw a tweet of a headline, to steal a line from Knives Out, about the Winter Classic and how they had to warm up the rink because it was too cold for the ice, which is a terrifying headline to read when we then think about the soccer that might be played there. But Joe, you were Minnesota Joe briefly. You're back to being Arizona Joe. Are you aware that that's a nickname that you've now acquired?
I wasn't until right now, but we'll add it to the list, Taylor. We'll add it
to the list. All right. I'm glad it's on the list. Joining us, a man who is trying to book a hire car in the U.S. for 2 weeks in 2022. It's Graham Ruthven. Graham, hello. I have questions.
Hello, Taylor Rockwell. Okay, what are those questions?
Is a hire car a rental car, or
yes,
are you getting chauffeured around America?
It's so much fancier.
No, it's a rental car. I think that might just be a difference between American and British.
I'm only calling rental cars hire cars from now on. That's so much better.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go. But it then begs the question, Graham, where are you heading? Are you and Minnesota Joe finally getting together to eat some meat pies?
Just not on this trip. So we're hopefully going to Florida on a family holiday that has been cancelled twice already in the last 2 years. So I'm not putting any great stock in this one actually happening. But I suppose I better actually try and line some things up and find a car. But thankfully, Twitter had some helpful suggestions, which isn't always the case. But I think I might actually have found something. So thank you, TSS Twitter.
There you go. Well, I was really hopeful that it was going to be a Florida chauffeur just driving you around for a couple weeks and we would get some good stories about that. Alas, you just have to rent your own car and drive around.
Yeah, it's just Ryan and his Mustang. That's what's going to drive me around.
Such a family-friendly car, Ryan Bailey owns.
In between his visits to various American-themed restaurants.
What side of the road do you all drive on over there, Graham?
So we drive on the left side of the road.
That's what I thought. How strange of a transition is that when you come over here?
Not that strange. I'm not sure I've got that many interests. Some people do struggle with it. Like, my wife doesn't drive in America whenever I'm over there. But I find it quite easy. You got big, wide roads.
Yeah, we do.
There's a margin for error there.
I think that's a burn. That's a dig on our roads. But I don't care, because I like our well-paved roads when they're well-paved, which is intermittently. Let's stop talking about roads and weather and traffic and all that. Let's talk about the weekend that was, as I said. Let's start in the Premier League. Arsenal 1, Man City 2. My thesis on this game is that if Man City were going to lose the title, if we were going to get a hotly contested title race, they would have lost this game. Arsenal very aggressive, quick passing through the press. City sort of lackluster, overrun in midfield at times. Even Pep came out afterward and said Arsenal was the better team. And yet, Graham, City get the win. But were you impressed by this Arsenal performance?
Absolutely. This is one of those games, and we have had these sort of matches before this season on the podcast, where I have much more to say about the team that lost than the team that won. And I think there were plenty of encouraging signs from this match for Arsenal. I thought, had their mindset been a little bit stronger and had they avoided that second half implosion, they might well have won this match. I haven't seen Manchester City pushed like this in a Premier League match for quite some time. And I thought one of the most impressive things, particularly in the first half, which is obviously when Arsenal were at their best, was the high press. You know, you had the front four of Lacazette, Saka, Odegaard, Martinelli, all pressing high in unison with Thomas Partey in behind to provide some cohesion. And obviously it helped that City seemed to be a bit sluggish, and on a sharper day they might have been able to play through that Arsenal press a bit better. But I thought Arsenal were very effective in their game plan, and it gave City real problems that I don't think they actually solved until, as I say, Arsenal kind of imploded a little bit in the second half, and then they were their own worst enemies. And I think that is an encouraging thing for Arteta, is that the one thing that seems to be holding back his players now in that team is mindset. And that is a very young team, and that might just be something that comes with a little bit of maturity, or with sending Granit Xhaka out on loan, whichever one of the two comes first.
Well said there. So Joe, we are 2 for 2 in our praise for Arsenal. Are you going to make it 3 for 3?
3 for 3, baby. 3 for 3. I thought they were good in this game, guys. And I think almost everybody who watched this game thought the same thing. I was impressed by a lot of what Arsenal did in a number of different phases. Graham mentioned defensively that high press. It was strong and it was intricate in a lot of those different movements. I noticed in this game, it was a lot of Martinelli on that left side shadowing João Cancelo, but also tucking inside, also pressing forward. It was flexible in that regard, but also strict in the roles. And so I was really impressed by that. And then I read a piece by Ahmed Walid on Twitter, who had a great article out about this that fleshed out kind of some of the things I'd been seeing in a lot more detail. And he had a bunch of screenshots and a great piece. I can't recommend that piece enough. Go find him on Twitter. I watched and I was impressed by a lot of the defensive things. I was also impressed by a lot of what we see with Arsenal on the ball. In this game, they go long from goal. They do that a lot more than a lot of the other big teams in the Premier League do. And they had some success with it. 10th minute, Aaron Ramsdale, long ball forward to Martinelli on that left side. A couple passes later, and you've got that Ederson tackle on Odegaard in the box that went to VAR and ultimately was ruled not a penalty. They have success going long. They were able to consistently threaten for a middle chunk of the first half, which is, again, to Graham's initial point, not something that a lot of teams tend to do against Manchester City. It just doesn't happen a whole lot, and Arsenal did that stuff. They found Martin Odegaard between the lines, which I thought was extremely impressive as this linking, combining, number 10 type of player. Thomas Partey and Granit Xhaka were getting involved, especially Partey, who I was really impressed by in this game. So yeah, a lot to like here from Arsenal, and extremely unfortunate that they go down to 10 men in the second half and they just can't hold things together.
Generally speaking, the only thing I care less about than VAR drama would be AFC Wimbledon, since Ryan isn't here. But let's pause for a moment. You mentioned that penalty shout. City have one of their own, which is given. And I'm inclined to say Odegaard's should have been a penalty, and the foul on Bruno should also have been, not Bruno, excuse me, Bernardo Silva. I was going to say Bruno Silva. That's not correct. Bernardo Silva, I feel like that also was a penalty. So I think VAR 1 for 2 on the day. Do either of you agree or disagree?
I, to be honest, Taylor, I just struggle to muster sort of any kind of enthusiasm for this chat. I understand that there is some inconsistency there. The Odegaard one, I initially thought it was a penalty, and then I looked at a different angle, and Odegaard, there's an angle where it looks like actually
weird.
Odegaard stamps on City goalkeeper Ederson. Sorry, that escaped my mind there. Yeah, it looks like he stamps on Ederson's ankle a little bit, so that angle kind of threw me off slightly, and I do wonder maybe if the officials in the VAR have seen that and maybe just went, we'll just stick with the on-field decision. The City one I thought was a penalty. It was slightly soft, but probably just about on the right side. But as I say, BT, who showed this game over here, the post-match analysis was completely dominated by chat about those decisions. So I think I've had my fill of controversy over those.
Then let's talk about individual moments. Let's talk about happier things than VAR. Graham, you mentioned Thomas Partey earlier, so too did Joe. How critical do you think he was to this performance? How important do you think he is to this Arsenal team right now?
So this was a performance that showed for me that something has clicked for Thomas Partey and this team, and it was a sort of all-action performance I expected to see more of from him when he signed for Arsenal. I thought when they got him, that wasn't this summer, that was the summer before, wasn't it? Wow, time is flying. 18 months ago, when they got him 18 months ago, I thought it was a real coup. I thought, no disrespect to Arsenal, but they were in a bit of a slump at that moment. I thought maybe if he was to leave Atleti, he'd maybe go to a team in a better place than Arsenal. So I thought it was a really strong addition. And we haven't really seen him at his best But this was much more like it from him. Looking at some of the stats off the stat sheet, he won 9 out of 15 duels. He won 8 ball recoveries, which I think is a crucial stat that kind of shows how he was robbing the ball off City a lot in the centre of the pitch. He completed 5 out of 6 take-ons, which is another key stat because he wasn't just a protective barrier in front of the back four. A lot of Arsenal's passing play was flowing through him, particularly in the movements out to Martinelli on the left side. He won 4 tackles as well. So I think he is finally, he had a difficult start to the season. A few weeks ago, we were talking about what's going on with Thomas Partey. He's not playing as he should. It's a little bit cruel that after a performance like this, when Arsenal might have finally unlocked him as one of their most important players, he is now off to the Africa Cup of Nations. But I guess such is life, and Arsenal should have planned for that because we all knew that was going to happen at this point of the year.
That we did. So they will not have Thomas Partey. They will continue to have Martin Odegaard. Joe, Martin Odegaard is a player that we praised last week on the Weekend Review. You were not with us, so I want to give you an opportunity now. VAR aside, because I don't want to make Graham audibly sigh into the microphone, have you been enjoying what you've seen from Martin Odegaard? And I should add, Joe Lowry, I think, is joining us on very limited sleep, having had his flights delayed. So, Joe, I appreciate that you are even here with us today. And anything you have to say about Martin Odegaard would be appreciated by me and by him, I'm assuming.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Martin's listening. He's listening. Of course. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Graham,
yeah,
I know
got
that.
Got you.
I'm a big fan of Martin Odegaard's game, and I'm still waiting for the consistent type of performance from him that I know he can generate, that we've seen from him in the past in bits and pieces at Madrid and in other places. I'm still waiting for that to click, but he's still an undeniable contributor to games like this. He didn't come out and thread the ball behind the back line a whole lot, right? He didn't come out and put on a Kevin De Bruyne or a Trent Alexander-Arnold type of passing performance from the 10 spot, but he still connects play really, really well. I think about the goal, which we haven't talked about yet, and I'm going to talk about it now because it was an unreal type of team goal. It's Saka's goal in the 31st minute for Arsenal, their only one in this game. Arsenal win the ball back in their half, and it's a quick bit of combination to find Martin Odegaard between the lines. And that's what he does so well. He finds space. He got in behind Bernardo and in behind Rodri in this game for City and punished them in that space. Not in zone 14, not in any particular zone of the field, but relative to where those two holding midfielders were for City and relative to where their two center backs were in their 4-4-2 defensive shape. That's what you want out of that 10 type of player. He gets on the ball in the sequence in the 31st minute and quickly plays it out wide to Kieran Tierney. Tierney then drives up the field and slides it on the floor to Saka near the penalty spot. And this is when I want to share some credit to players who are not Martin Odegaard, because there's a lot of people involved in this goal, and it wouldn't have happened without all of these individual contributions. The pass, first of all, from Tierney is beautiful. The run from Saka to bend and kind of curl back around close to the penalty spot after he was running towards the right side of the box. He curls and bends inside, but he wouldn't have space to receive the ball if Lacazette's movement didn't take multiple City defenders with him. So Lacazette's running directly towards goal, maybe a bit to the right, and then Saka curls around behind. And I'm exaggerating it a little bit. It's a bit more subtle than this. But all of those pieces are working together. Tierney's ball arrives as Saka's curling around to meet it, and he hits it first time and finds the back of the net. This goal, with contributions, from Odegaard and from Tierney and from players deeper in Arsenal's midfield and from Lacazette moving off the ball and from Saka moving off the ball to receive the ball, that's just such well-coordinated movement. And I see this goal and I think, man, Arsenal could be really, really dangerous on the break. And they are dangerous at times on the break. But when you have that combination from all of those players who I would argue thrive in those transition-type opportunities, that's when Arsenal look really, really dangerous. And to reiterate kind of the theme from this game, it's a shame that they didn't have a couple other moments like this that actually resulted with the ball being in the back of the net, because this one easily could have gone a different way.
And we will talk about a little bit about City, at least. But just sticking with Odegaard one more time, with like how influential he has been to Arsenal's attack, are there concerns that he can like defenses can sort of focus on him, man mark him, limit his effectiveness, limit his involvement, and thus sort of shut down the potency of Arsenal's attack? Or with the fluidity that you've described, do you feel like if they overly focus on one player, all that does is just open up space for other attackers to have even more opportunities?
That's the risk you run, right, Taylor? That's the risk you run. To be honest, I don't think Martin Odegaard is quite good enough to warrant that sort of defensive treatment. He's a key cog, but I still think he's just a cog. He's not moving things around all by himself at this point. So I don't think that would be my defensive approach if I was City or if I was Arsenal's next opponent. But still, when you do that sort of thing, and when you naturally, and I think defenses are inclined to do this, when you naturally give a bit more attention to the 10, to the player who's floating around in space between the lines, if you step too hard, then you do leave space for Saka on the right. You leave space for Martinelli on the left. You leave space for Lacazette, who, let's not forget, can be an extremely dangerous number 9, as we're talking about, you know, Vlahovic and whoever else Arsenal might bring in this window or in the summer. So it's a danger when you have this much talent on the field. Maybe it's Thomas Partey driving forward from deep. Graham, you mentioned 5 of 6 take-ons in this game. He's a threat on the ball. He's a threat to drive forward and carve through you on the dribble. So Arsenal are getting to the point right now when if they're functioning at this high level that we saw in this game, and we've seen that they can, that if you give too much attention to Odegaard or to any particular player, you could be in trouble in those situations.
Graham, we've been pretty heavily focused on the attacking side of Odegaard's gameplay. Am I correct in saying that you were pretty pleased by his defensive work as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So within the first 10 minutes of the match, so I've become a massive Martin Odegaard fan. It's a common theme on this podcast.
It does feel like, is he in the top 10 list of non-Scottish players that you have like a rooting affinity for?
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of it is because I think there is an arrogance from certain English pundits, who I won't name, anyone who maybe isn't, you know, a household name coming from Spain or the Bundesliga or wherever, and coming to one of the big teams in England, they automatically, they roll out certain cliches about them. You know, they don't run hard enough. You know, they're not the right fit. They don't get the club. And a lot of those things were rolled out about Odegaard when he signed for Arsenal, because I thought a lot of people, as we have previously discussed in the podcast, thought he was the new Mesut Ozil. And so they associated him with a lot of the bad qualities that Ozil had. And so seeing him in the first 10 minutes, you know, leading the high press, and particularly early on, he was gesturing to his teammates to get up and join him in that high press. And so that to me just illustrates why he's the perfect midfield creator for Arteta. Yes, he is an excellent passer of the ball. Yes, he has a goal threat, but he is more than willing to play his part off the ball. And in particular, one of the things that Arsenal did really well in the first half and until the sending off was they denied any access for City into Rodri, who is such a key component for City this season. He's really become one of the most important players. And Odegaard was key in blocking that route for City into Rodri. And City struggled to play out from the back with their deepest midfielder, who tends to be Rodri, completely blocked off. And that was one of the things Odegaard did in this off-the-ball structure for Arsenal. So yes, he's fantastic on the ball, but I think the reason Arteta likes him so much and why he favours someone like him over Ozil, who was obviously shown the door very early on, is for what he does off the ball.
Graham, one other Arsenal player I think we have to talk about for a moment is Nuno Tavares. Hasn't put a foot wrong in their last 5 games. Graham, can you talk about the man that is Arsenal's best left back by some distance, Nuno Tavares?
No, I feel like this is a wind-up effort going on here.
I believe he has not played in their last 5 games, which is why he technically hasn't put a foot wrong.
Yeah, I was a bit concerned a few weeks ago, I will admit, when Nuno Tavares was seemed to have replaced Tierney in the Arsenal starting lineup. He had a couple good games, but I thought Tierney had an excellent game at left back here. He's played really well recently, and I just think there's no context. Maybe Nuno Tavares, you know, he's a very young player. Maybe he develops more to his game. Maybe he learns from Tierney. But I just think there's no contest between the two, in my opinion. I appreciate that I am slightly biased. Kieran Tierney is one of my favourite players in the world. I think he's probably Scotland's best left back. I've always been a little bit more Team Tierney than Team Robertson, to be honest. But I think this performance showed why he's so important to Arsenal. One of the best things about Tierney, and we saw this in the goal, is his willingness to drive inside when there is space to do so. Scotland have made really good use of that quality. He plays kind of left-sided centre-back, but he has that ability to get forward. I'm pleased to see that Arteta is also making use of that. And you see Joao Cancelo do something similar for City. He often will drive into the centre midfield, and it just gives Arsenal a bit of a different dimension. You know, they not only do they have someone who can get around on the overlap, which is something Tierney does a lot, they also have someone, as I say, who can drive into central midfield, and that's where the pass for the Arsenal goal comes from. So very pleased to see Mr. Tierney doing well in this one.
As I said, we will talk a little bit about Man City right now, because they do end up getting the win. And I think at the start of this game review, I was saying that this felt like a game that if there were going to be a title challenge, if they were going to slip, they would have lost this one. But Arsenal looking as good as they did, kind of going at Man City, making them uncomfortable. And yet in the end, Joe, it is a win for City. They kind of grind it out. You could argue they get fortunate. Again, I don't think they do. I think it's a penalty. I think they get the win. They get the 3 points. It's, as Graham said, it's hard to talk about Man City sometimes because they are just such a machine at being good. But is there anything that stands out to you about this Man City team? Anything that you're particularly enjoying? I liked Nathan Ake's goal line clearance. I like that extra effort. I did not love the referee making an even more darting run than Martinelli to kind of block off the shooting opportunity. I missed that on first watch on replay. I have some issues with the official overall. But Joe, anything stand out to you from Man City's performance?
I have one tactical thing, but before that, that sequence, we haven't even really gotten to it in the second half, that sequence where Man City get their goal and it goes to VAR and then Mahrez puts the penalty in, and then you've got Arsenal who nearly come right back and score to get ahead, and that's the Laporte header over the top and Ederson has to scramble back and he doesn't get onto the ball, obviously. And then Ake has to make that goal line save. And then just moments after that, that's Gabriel getting sent off with a second yellow card for a challenge on Gabriel Jesus, and then Arsenal go down to 10. It's this insane 10-minute stretch that completely changes the game and could have changed it two or three times within that sequence itself. That was bonkers, and City pretty much dominate after Arsenal go down to 10 and they get that second goal to win it in the 93rd minute from Rodri. The tactical thing for me in this game that I was most intrigued by with City is something we've seen before. It's not new, but it is new within the context of like global soccer tactics history, that kind of thing. This game, City come out with a back three, and you've got Nathan Ake, and you've got Laporta, and then you've got Ruben Diaz all in that space. But rarely did they actually look like a back three, or maybe 50% of the time they looked like a back three in possession. The other times it was Cancelo playing a bit deeper on that right side to be a right back and Ake on the left. And other times still, this is the thing that was most interesting to me. You have Ederson stepping forward functionally to play as a right center back or a left center back in possession. And we've seen that a few times in the past from City and from a few other teams around Europe and around the world. But we don't see it all the time. And anytime I see that kind of thing, anytime I see a goalkeeper coming up to be a part of a back four in possession, it catches my eye because we don't see that a lot in the history of soccer. It's a risky move. You have to be confident in that player's ability to participate and build up and to participate in possession. And with some of the passes that Ederson puts out on a regular basis, it's really no surprise that he fills that role sometimes for City.
Norwich fans, you can go ahead and earmuff it for a moment. Joe, if Ederson played for Norwich, would he be a goalkeeper or would he be a midfielder?
He would still be a goalkeeper, okay. Taylor, but the gulf is a little bit smaller. The gulf in class is a little bit smaller in that situation.
And Joe, thank you for like kind of explaining the chaos that was those 10 minutes, because I think that is part of where my introduction focused on the kind of weirdness of this one, because it felt like Arsenal very strong, playing well, then there's the penalty, then there's the red card. Gabriel very angry about the second yellow. I think that was maybe protesting a little bit too much, because if you watch the replay, he knows as soon as he makes that foul, I'm getting a second yellow. And I think then the anger comes from realizing what that might mean. I watched the City goal thinking maybe I'll be able to figure something out. Maybe there'll be an interesting nugget here. And in the end, it's just sort of numbers in the box, tired legs at the end, and City able to get the win. Not the most impressive performance in terms of like goals and assists from João Cancelo, Graham, but I think understandable sort of given what happened this past week.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think Cancelo has been one of the players of the season in the Premier League this year. I don't think he had the best of matches here, which there were probably a couple factors in that. So the one that you referenced there is an off-the-field factor. So he was assaulted in his home on New Year's Day. I believe his family was in his house with him as well. So he actually played this match with a cut above his eye. So I can imagine that was the sort of thing that would shake your mentality ahead of a big match. So that might have been a factor. And also the fact he's playing at right back, I guess, on paper, but it's even considering that isn't his best position. I always think he's better at left back. It was a slightly, as Joe said, he was playing a lot deeper than he would normally do. And so he was being asked to do things he wouldn't normally be asked to do. And I just think, yeah, as I say, this was proof that Cancelo for me is a better option for City at left back, but with Walker and Zinchenko out, Guardiola didn't really have much choice to play him there. And Nathan Ake is playing at left back. And I'll use a football manager analogy where I always get nervous when I have to play a player who has a DLC or a DRC in a fullback position, and I think that's exactly what happened with City with Ake. He can play there, but it's not his best position, and it's not Cancelo's best position to play in that way on the right side either. So we'll give him a pass, given that he has had an excellent season so far, and as we say, all the kind of off-the-field factors as well.
All right, so that's Man City 2, Arsenal 1. We will be back in just a moment to talk some more Premier League. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. Welcome back. Let's talk Chelsea 2, Liverpool 2, a game that felt like it might be a blowout, then felt like it might be an incredibly high-scoring game, and ended up goalless in the second half. But we should probably start with one of the major talking points, the absence of Romelu Lukaku. Thomas Tuchel chooses not only not to start him, but not to include him in the squad. Some reporting I have seen suggests that Tuchel met with 5 to 6 senior players who kind of all agreed that it was the correct decision. I think Tuchel trying to keep squad harmony to the level he can, but rumored to be Jorginho, Conte, Rudiger, and Azpilicueta involved in that choice. Graham, can you talk a bit about what the sort of situation is and where it sort of leaves Tuchel, how it forces his hand a bit?
Yeah, so for anyone that doesn't know, Lukaku last week, an interview surfaced where he basically, now this is where there's a little bit of confusion. Mm-hmm. There is a debate over what the true translation of what he said in this interview was, but basically the gist of it is that he is concerned, shall we say, with how things have gone at Chelsea this season. He has concerns about the system that Tuchel is using, the way that he is being used, and he expressed his love and his desire for Inter Milan, who obviously he played for previously, which then raises prospects of, oh, well, does he want to leave Chelsea? Does he want to go back to Inter Milan? And the context of all this is that he has been in and out of the team. Obviously, he has been injured as well for a spell, which is a definite factor, but he has also been in and out of the team recently. Tuchel hasn't really unlocked the best of Lukaku after a very positive start. I remember saying in his first two games that Tuchel definitely knew how to work Lukaku and how to get the best out of him. I'm not sure what happened, but there seems to be a regression over the course of the season. And so this led to Tuchel leaving Lukaku not just out of his team for this one, but out of the squad entirely. And obviously that has led to even more debate about whether that was the right thing to do. I personally can understand why Tuchel took the stance that he did. It was a big distraction ahead of this match. And I do think while Lukaku is entirely within his rights to be honest, and I don't really have much issue, maybe if I was a Chelsea fan, I'd be different given that he's just signed for the club. But My objection to what he did isn't necessarily that he said he had concerns about the system, and even that he was unhappy at Chelsea. Let's just take it at crude value. You know, if that's what he said, I wouldn't have an issue with that, really. It was more the fact that Chelsea didn't know about this interview, the fact that it was an unauthorized interview. And so I think that is the part that I sympathize with for Tuchel and why he'd be upset and why some of those Chelsea players would be upset. However, I also do think Tuchel now has a responsibility to defuse this situation quickly, or it could become the sort of thing that could sink a manager or become something, a factor in a larger sort of demise for Tuchel, particularly at a club like Chelsea, where they might side, say these bad results continue for Chelsea, they might side with a £98 million asset over a manager. I mean, Chelsea have a track record for doing that sort of thing. So I think one match out is suitable punishment enough. Tuchel now needs to sort this before it becomes something bigger.
It's really strange to me that it could be a nothing story in the end, or it could be the end of Tuchel's time at Chelsea, or potentially Lukaku's. That seems less likely. But like the initial quote, the way it's tweeted by Fabrizio Romano, who is the one who's interviewing Lukaku, makes it seem as though he says, "I am unhappy at Chelsea. I don't like what the manager is doing. I miss Inter," and goes into how much he loves playing for Inter. And it's worth noting, the interview was with, I can't remember which Italian outlet it was. It was Fabrizio Romano doing the interview, but the point of it was to talk about Lukaku's departure from Inter, how sudden it was, and how, going back to it for a moment, he had said, "I'm not leaving. I want to be here for a long time." He had told teammates he wasn't leaving, and then suddenly he's gone. I think it left a bad taste in a lot of the mouths of Inter supporters, and so this was meant to be a clear-the-air interview. It begins with him being asked, like, "Do you swear to tell the whole truth?" And then he's immediately asked, like, "How are things right now?" And that's when he goes into, like, "I'm not that happy." And so I can see it being just a sort of honest interview, and some of the quotes get taken out of context or combined. But when you read the entire interview, he makes other comments about how he had expected to join one of the three best teams in Europe, but when none of them were interested, then it was only Chelsea for him. And like, that's meant to be a compliment, but it also sounds like a dig. And there's just so many of those little moments. Graham, as you said, it being an unauthorized interview that Chelsea did not know about, that seems to be another major point for them, that nobody was consulted, nobody was told, so it kind of blindsided the club when it became public. That does feel like it could just be a, "Hey man, it's got to be better, like, let us know what's going on, but I hope you feel more involved in the team," and maybe they talk out some of the tactics and it's squashed, or it just kind of grows from here and gets worse. But it's strange that it could be nothing, or it could be very much something. And I guess we'll just have to wait and see how the talks go today and this week.
I just love the quote from Tuchel after this is all sort of played out. He's asked how Chelsea can get the best out of Lukaku, and this is the direct quote: "Training, training, playing, training, playing, training, sleeping, eating good, training, playing, sleeping, eat good, drink a lot of water," that's a good one, "sleep, train, and don't give interviews." That's my favorite quote. Maybe, I know it's only January 3rd as a recording, but certainly my favorite quote of the year so far. And it might be a bit tough to beat. Eat good, drink a lot of water, and don't give interviews.
Graham, I think at least part of that quote was self-interested, because when it comes to drinking a lot of water, you were kind enough to share the photo of Thomas Tuchel sweating through his his down jacket, which is no small feat. I'm assuming he needed some hydration after this game.
Yeah, so that was actually Ryan who added the caption, "I am a sweaty man, but I don't think even I could do this."
Oh, was it Ryan who shared that, or did you give it to us initially?
No, it was Ryan who brought it up. But that definitely takes some doing, and I side with Ryan. Even on one of his half marathons, I doubt that Mr. Bailey could sweat through a puffer jacket.
Oh man, that is quite the look. That is quite the look. Joe, I was I guess impressed by Thomas Tuchel's ability to sweat. Maybe not impressed as much as I was horrified. Were you horrified and then impressed by Christian Pulisic in this game?
Yeah, it was a bit of an up and down performance from Christian Pulisic, the LeBron James of soccer. There's so many jokes being made here, guys. They're just all over Twitter, all over our WhatsApp group chat. It's a beautiful thing. I've never been more grateful for History Channel airing Pawn Stars. Anyway, it was not a good start to this game from Christian Pulisic. Hugely wasteful in the first 10 minutes. So the first thing that we got to talk about is the opportunity he has to round the keeper after Kai Havertz sort of redirects the ball towards him after a bit of pressure. He has a chance to round the keeper and doesn't, and it's made to look a bit worse because Sadio Mane scores doing something very, very similar a few minutes later. I'm not inclined to really harp too much in a situation like that. Christian Pulisic is a world-class attacker, and he's not always been in the best of form this season, but those kinds of things happen to even the best players in the world. So that happens, but it certainly goes towards the wasteful tally. He has two failed dribbles, which I am inclined to harp on a bit more, because Taylor, if we've seen anything with him in World Cup qualifying for the US when he's been fit, which hasn't been too often, it's that he often holds on to the ball a little bit too long. He's so clearly, for the US, the quickest and most agile player on the ball in terms of dribbling. But at times, the ball is just not coming off of his foot fast enough. So he has those moments, the failed dribbles, the missed attempt to round the keeper and get a shot on goal, and then gets a yellow card for a challenge on Diogo Jota in the 17th minute. It's not a good start from him at all in this game. And then things start to turn around, maybe even a bit before the yellow card. But after the first 10, 15, 20 minutes, it's a different performance from him. He starts to release the ball quicker, which is huge. He scores the goal. It's the second goal for Chelsea to get them really in this game right before halftime. And it's a nice finish from him after making a run in behind and Conte plays him the ball over the top. It's a good goal. And then he has these moments where he's really good with his movement in the box. It's especially visible 62nd minute where he cuts across a defender and gets a shot on goal. It's saved, but those moments are exactly the types of movements you want in the box from your weak side winger, from your front line, from anyone really in those spaces. And then he's creative. He showed some of that flair and some of the things that he loves to do, but actually using them in a functional way. He has a really nice back heel in the 63rd minute. Just it turned into a really strong performance from him in the front line. He finishes off the game at right wing back, which I don't think is anyone's favorite thing besides Thomas Tuchel's, but gets the job done there, I suppose. So it really did turn around for Christian Pulisic in this game after a very much not LeBron James-esque performance.
Was I the only one who found the Pulisic finish really kind of peculiar? When watching that, I'm going, don't shoot like that, you're going to lob it over the bar. It was almost like an underarm tennis serve, but he manages to keep it flat and with power. I'm not quite sure. I mean, it was a great finish, but technically it was peculiar, I have to say. But you're right, Joe. He started so badly, and I thought, oh my goodness, he's going to get hooked by Tuchel within 25 minutes. He's going to get substituted off here. But it did turn around for him, thankfully. And actually, until he moved back to right wing back, I thought, along with Kovacic, he was probably Chelsea's best performer.
Yeah, I completely agree, Graham. You think about how he started in this game. I didn't think there was a chance that he would outshine Mason Mount or Kai Havertz in this game in terms of those front runners. But he did. I think he turned into one of their best players. And really, the last 80 minutes of Christian Pulisic, maybe 60 if we cut out the right wing back time, that's the Christian Pulisic that the U.S. needs in January and February and in March. I mean, that's the kind of player that Greg Berhalter wants and is a guaranteed starter for this team. Otherwise, if we're getting Christian Pulisic for the first 10, 15, 20 minutes, or Christian Pulisic that we've seen at times in World Cup qualifying already, it's a much harder choice for Greg Berhalter in that left wing spot.
Before I let Christian Pulisic off the hook a little bit, Graham, how am I supposed to pronounce Liverpool's backup goalkeeper's last name? Is it Kelleher or is it just Keller?
Oh, so Kelleher is correct, but I have no idea on the first name.
All right. Oh, no. We'll just stick with Kelleher.
The first name's even more difficult. And it's one of those ones where if he gets any better and continues to play, I'm going to have no choice but to learn how to say his name.
I mean, that can be your homework for next weekend review, Graham. Okay. You've got a week to figure it out. But in the meantime, I'll say this. Christian Pulisic did not have a ton of time to react to that ball. Joe, I didn't watch this game live. I saw Graham messaging the group about, like, oof, that was not great. So watching it like with that in mind, I do wonder if that maybe influenced a little bit. But I've watched it probably 10 times trying to figure out if there was anything he could have done differently. And I'm not sure there is, because when he gets that ball, Kelleher is already off his line, I think, because he wasn't expecting that ball to go there. But I think he was expecting Liverpool to be in possession a little bit more and is then trying to step out, I think, because he's expecting the ball to be cleared. And so I think Pulisic has a like less of a gap to have the time to figure out what he wants to do. And I also looked at that Sadio Mane goal, and I think Mane does have that extra few yards to sort of size up the goalkeeper, Mendy, and then decide what he's going to do. And he waits for Mendy to commit, and then he cuts around him. I don't think Pulisic had that luxury. So I am inclined to let him off the hook a little bit for that one, even if the Chelsea supporters maybe aren't. And they certainly weren't for some of those misplaced passes and being dispossessed in midfield. But Graham, I agree Pulisic had a strong game. I really agree with you that Kovacic was a standout performer, and I think is at least part of the reason why Chelsea have struggled lately. From a Guardian piece I read, Chelsea have conceded only 4 goals in Kovacic's 10 league starts this season. 3 of those have come in the past 2 games, when Tuchel acknowledged Kovacic was rushed back. I thought he was instrumental in Chelsea looking solid once they started to look solid. What did you make of Mateo Kovacic, Graham?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought he was the best Chelsea player on the pitch, and not just for that Michael Essien-esque volley to get Chelsea back in the game, which, talking about technique, was somehow amazing technique and strange technique. It was the same. Both Chelsea finishes, I thought the technique was both brilliant and strange. I mean, I think it's because he hits it so square on. He hits it so it's almost like his foot comes straight out from his body, which you don't often see, and when you do see that, it tends to be someone at five-a-side soccer thumping the ball over the fence into the river, and so for him to stick that into the top corner off the inside of the post was quite incredible. But looking at his stats, I'm going to run out some numbers from the stat sheet again. So 100% tackle success rate, 100% take-ons completed, 100% aerial duels won, 13 duels won in total, which was the most of any player on the pitch, 11 ball recoveries, 11 final third entries, 6 tackles made, which was the most of anyone on the pitch, and 4 take-ons completed, which again was the most of anyone on the pitch. And I think that says a lot about the performance he put in the centre of the pitch. And I thought where Chelsea had the advantage in this game was in the centre of the pitch, because I thought Liverpool had a lot of trouble in that area. So if you look at the statistics for Liverpool in midfield, so the caveat is they have a number of injuries at the moment and COVID cases, which meant they played Jordan Henderson and Milner in front of Fabinho. He started this game, didn't he? So Milner completed 65% of 20 passes, which is quite incredible. And Liverpool just didn't have the ability to control the match. On average, their completed pass success rate is 84.3% in the Premier League this season. That rate dropped to 75% for this match, which just kind of illustrates how they found it very difficult to hold on to the ball. And Chelsea also had those troubles as well. You know, that there were a number of turnovers, particularly in the first half. I think I read that there were 65 exchanges of possession in the first half, which is the most of any Premier League first half this season, which again is just another illustrative number that shows the sort of match we had. It was a very open end-to-end encounter. And while Kovacic played well, while Pulisic played well, while Liverpool players like Salah played well and Mane ended his goal drought, I think we saw enough flaws in both teams to suggest that neither of them are going to catch Manchester City this season. And this was the weekend. We all knew it was trending in this direction, but this was the weekend where we had confirmation in my eyes that City are the de facto champions in waiting.
Yeah, Rebecca Lowe in the post-match for NBC Sports was savage but accurate. Like, the game ends, we go right back to the studio, and she says, basically, so, a draw, pretty much the worst result that either of these teams could have hoped for. And that is pretty accurate, because it does give City all that much more of a gap. But I think still it is a sort of fair reflection of the way this game went, especially given that it seemed like Liverpool going to run out to easy victors, Chelsea find a way back in. And then I think, Graham, to your point, a lot of the kind of openness led to a lot of the mistakes, which led to a lot of the opportunities, which led to even more openness. And I think in the second half, everything got clamped down a little bit more. I think it was much more conservative. And I think that's why we don't get the sort of highlight reel game that maybe we thought we might be poised for. Instead, we get a happy Man City and a somewhat happy Liverpool. I would say a slightly less happy Chelsea because of the Lukaku factor. But we'll see how that plays out. Gentlemen, anything else from this game before we keep it moving?
I just want to add to support Graham's idea about this result really being poor for Liverpool and Chelsea. According to 538, which is a website that does a lot of good stats stuff, City have an 85% chance to win the Premier League. Liverpool have a 13% chance. Chelsea have a 2% chance. And every other team is significantly less than 1%. This one is pretty much done, as are a number of the other title races in Europe.
Yeah, right.
This season still has plenty of exciting moments left in it. I just think maybe most of those moments will be in the Champions League rather than in domestic play.
If only we could devise a single division for all of Europe that got all those teams that are almost certain to win their title in their respective countries, and we got them together and we put them in the one league, and we could call it, I don't know, the Mega League?
Yeah. Graham, that sounds like a super idea. That is just super, super good. Super into that.
I see what we're doing here. I see what's happening. Well, until we get that, which we probably inevitably will, let's talk about the individual leagues. Let's talk about La Liga for a second. Graham, again, continuing the weirdness of the weekend, we get Real Madrid losing Getafe with a 1-0 win. I don't know what Militao was doing in this one. He is dispossessed and then chooses to protest losing the ball as opposed to playing actual defense. But a good goal for Getafe, an even better win, but maybe not the most surprising of losses for Real Madrid.
Yeah, that, absolutely. I think this sort of result and performance had been coming for Real Madrid. So there is a train of thought that this is Real Madrid reverting to the mean a little bit. As I say, that the numbers of their recent performances suggested something like this was coming. Before this match, they had overperformed their expected goals by 0.4 per game. Before the goalless draw at home to Cadiz before Christmas, that was even higher. It was at 0.6, but it's still the highest of any other team in La Liga, and it's the joint fifth highest overperformance of any side in the top five European leagues this season. And it isn't too difficult to explain why that might be the case, because Karim Benzema and Vinicius Jr. in particular have been in such incredible form where they've been popping in shots from outside the box for fun. Obviously, for this match, Vinicius is out with COVID. I would suggest maybe, you know, let's keep in mind the winter break in Spain is only 2 weeks long. I would suggest maybe going to Carolina to watch an NFL game and then spending the rest of your break in Miami and all that traveling involved at a crucial point of the season maybe wasn't the best idea, but that's just me. And you could see in this match that they missed him greatly. Hazard was given a chance in the second half, but at this point, you've probably got to think it's all over for him at Real Madrid. The only thing he's really got going for him is his relationship with Benzema. He just doesn't have any meaningful attacking output anymore, which is quite remarkable for a player who came so easily to him at Chelsea. But he is a very different player. I think physically is a big part of it. He can't accelerate away from players like he used to. So, yeah, I think this performance, this result, I wouldn't be surprised if there are more results like this in the pipeline for Real Madrid in the second half of the season, because the underlying numbers suggest that that will be the case.
Is there anything in particular, aside from like the loss of pace, that you see when it comes to Eden Hazard? Because that does feel like one of the most precipitous drop-offs in performance and ability that I can remember, and I'm still unclear as to what has happened aside from he moved there, there were the fitness issues, there were injury concerns, but it really, really has not gone well for him.
No, it hasn't. And there's a physical aspect to it. As I say, he's lost quite a bit of pace, but there's also that great intangible that we talk about with soccer players, confidence. He's completely short of confidence. And you see a number of times he gets himself into a position where he previously would have, you know, flashed across in front of goal, or he would have taken the shot on himself. And there's just that moments of hesitation where he cuts back, he kind of looks for a teammate and then realizes he's going to need to do something himself. And by that time, the defender blocks his shot or his cross. And that has kind of become the hallmark of Hazard as a Real Madrid player when he has been fit, and he has been fit this season. That's why I think this season it feels like there's more of a crossroads to his Real Madrid career than ever before, because in the last two seasons, you've said, well, you know, you just need to wait until he gets fit. He has shown signs of a relationship with Benzema, but all of a sudden now Real Madrid have players in his position, and it's not just Vinicius Jr. either. It's players like Marco Asensio, Lucas Vazquez. They're better options in Hazard's position for Real Madrid right now. And I think if there is an option for Real Madrid to get rid of him in January or at the end of the season, they won't hesitate. It kind of feels like his career there is already over.
And Graham, I do appreciate you calling out Vinny Jr. Because I think you're right. A lengthy trip to Florida in the middle of a pandemic is probably not a great idea. Where were you going again on vacation, Graham? Just quick question.
Oh, that's a tough one.
I don't have to play Getafe, though, a few days after I get back. Well, at least I hope not.
Hey, you never know. If the injury concerns keep mounting, maybe you will. Like, for example, Barcelona missing 14 players due to COVID injuries and suspensions. Graham, were you more impressed with that, like those players being absent, with Barcelona's win over Mallorca or with Getafe under their new manager getting that win against Real Madrid?
I mean, I think you always have to be more impressed by the underdog getting the victory
that
over the super club. And this was a lot more like it from Getafe under Kike Sanchez Flores, much more like the board last era, which we have seen from Getafe. Flores was appointed in October after a really bad start to the season by Getafe, but this was the first match we've really seen Getafe flourish a little bit under him. The Coliseum, which is Getafe's home stadium, it's not known for being the best atmosphere in La Liga. It's a bit of an out-of-town stadium in an industrial park, but they do respond, the crowd there do respond to hard running and an underdog spirit, and Getafe played with plenty of that here. They were really well organised, difficult to play through, and had a threat on the counter-attack, and against a Real Madrid team that didn't really have much cutting edge, that was enough for them. However, having said this, and I'll promise to stop talking at some point, Barcelona, I also thought, were really impressive.
Yeah.
A 1-0 win over Mallorca is, on the face of things, that isn't, you know, Barcelona should be able to achieve that fairly easily. But as you say, 14 players out missing with either injury or COVID cases. And that team was Kids and Luke de Jong, basically. And I thought a number of the experienced players actually stepped up. So Luke de Jong gets the winner in this match. Barcelona have finally found a purpose for Luke de Jong, which is shielding the ball at the corner flag to run down the clock. So that is his purpose at Barcelona. But being serious, Piqué had a much needed good game. Ter Stegen made a huge save towards the end in stoppage time. And Luke de Jong gets the goal. So this season, a big problem for Barcelona has been the experienced players in that team of Kids. They've actually been outshone by the Kids. On this occasion, the experienced ones kind of stood up and they fought. You know, Barcelona are not necessarily playing better under Xavi, but they are definitely fighting harder. And I think we saw that in this game.
Yeah, and I think I was surprised to hear Xavi be as excited as he was about this result, to talk about how the 3 points was, you know, as good as gold and how it was a historic win for Barcelona. And then I think he even owned that, like, that might sound like a bit of an exaggeration. But yeah, when you look at the starting 11, unless you are a Barcelona fan, and maybe even then, like, I feel like short of like Frankie de Jong, the one de Jong that you probably knew, there's Gerard Pique, there's Ter Stegen, Mengeza maybe, but then it really is a lot of young players. There's a 17-year-old in there. There's, like, basically a ton of inexperience. And for Xavi to kind of motivate that team to get the result, I did find myself wondering if this is, like, the thesis statement for why you get rid of Koeman and bring in Xavi, because this win under Koeman is sort of like, I guess it's good. I'm not quite sure if this is what his kind of long-term vision is or if it's just an emergency thing. Whereas when it's Xavi and there's this emphasis on bringing through the academy players, just as he did or just as he was, it looks more like this is a statement game of the youngsters can get it done and maybe they'll continue to grow from here. So I think it is a big win, even if it's only a 1-0 win, but it features Luke de Jong scoring and hitting a bicycle. So hitting the bar with a bicycle, not scoring, that would have been maybe like the headline moment of the weekend and making it even weirder. Final thing to mention from La Liga, Atleti 2, Rayo 0. A good win for Atleti. They break their losing streak. I think their longest one in a very long time under Diego Simeone. Maybe for purposes of a Premier League-centric show, like ours sometimes is, the big story would be that it seems, Graham, as though Kieran Trippier is on his way out.
Yeah, absolutely. Kieran Trippier, after this match, he stays behind on the pitch. He's the only one on the pitch, and he applauds all four sides of the Wanda Metropolitano, thanking the fans. He's obviously been a very important player for them over the last three seasons. Atleti are going to find it difficult to replace him. I think they have to move quickly to find a new right back in that system because he's been so important to them. But obviously there is a lot of speculation at the moment that Trippier is going back to the Premier League. Surprisingly, in my eyes anyway, Newcastle seems to be who are leading the chase. So Man United were linked in the summer. I think I even saw Arsenal were linked in the summer. Tottenham, they've been talking about a new right wing back, but none of those teams really seem to be pressing the issue in January this month with Trippier, and it's Newcastle who he seems to be on his way to. So, and Simeone said after the match as well, you know, Atleti not being able to, they don't want to keep a player who doesn't want to be at the club, which I just think is pretty telling and pretty much confirmation that he is on his way out of Atletico Madrid. But yeah, replacing him is going to be quite difficult. And I think we said on the Bleacher Report show we did that maybe Atleti wouldn't do that much in January. I think that is maybe the one move that they will look to do, is find a new right wing back.
I too was surprised by that link to Newcastle. I saw some reporting that he, Trippier, had previously worked with Eddie Howe when Eddie Howe was at Burnley for a year. I'm not quite sure how much overlap there was, but I guess some level of relationship there that maybe is a factor in that one, or maybe it's just, you know, Saudi oil money. That could also be a slightly large factor
as well.
Maybe one. Who knows? Who knows for sure?
One of the two.
But there are other players that are on the move, not even just speculatively, but actually on the move, Joe Lowry. We've got two Americans. I think you're 2 for 3 in your predictions, or you already had one on the move. So have you gotten your prediction for the year?
Yeah, so my very specific prediction on that Bleacher Report live show that we did on Thursday, thanks to everybody who watched that. We had a ton of fun doing it. The four of us, myself, Graham, Ryan, Taylor, the whole crew was involved, and it was a really great time on Thursday. Talking
giraffe.
Yeah, and so did Taylor. Well, I guess it's Revy's giraffe. Taylor kind of laid claim to it for a while.
So
if you didn't watch the show, everyone's super confused right now, and I'm honestly okay
here,
with
Joe.
That.
She's still here.
Okay, there's the giraffe. Wait, what's the giraffe's name again, Taylor?
Sophie.
There's Sophie. So it was really the five of us with Sophie. Anyway, long preamble aside, on that show, I made a very specific prediction that we would see three USMNT players move in January. Technically, that's already happened because you had Kyle Duncan moving already. There's some other pre-contract players that I had forgotten about. Caden Clark technically moved to RB Leipzig. And apparently, if reports are to be believed, he's actually going to be loaned back to the New York Red Bulls. So that's a bit of a tough situation for him. I'm sure disappointing there. Chris Mueller is going to Hibs in Scotland. Setting those aside, though, the two biggest names that have moved, Ricardo Pepi going to Augsburg for $20 million. It's a huge fee for FC Dallas. And the other one is Daryl Dike going to West Brom in the championship. Orlando will receive a $9.5 million fee, according to ESPN's Jeff Carlisle. These are massive deals. Now that they're both official, they're both in the top five in terms of outgoing transfer fees generated in Major League Soccer history. The league is certainly skewing more and more towards selling players on and getting bigger and bigger fees for those players. Positive signs for Major League Soccer, certainly. I do have some questions about both of these moves on an individual level. We'll talk more about that tomorrow on our American-centric show. But still, congratulations to both of those players moving to the next step in their career on a permanent basis. This is huge for both of those guys, and I'm hopeful for both of them that it'll turn out to be a good thing.
We will indeed talk about those moves in more depth tomorrow. We'll also probably mention Caden Clark again. I saw Manuel Vaith tweeting about that move back to New York and basically framing it more as a positive, which made me happy, that essentially with the uncertainty at Leipzig right now, managerial turnover, not quite sure how stable they're going to be for the rest of the season. I think they couldn't guarantee him the minutes, the opportunities that they would have liked. So instead, they're sending him back to get consistent minutes at club level. And that works for me. But I'm very excited for Daryl Dike. I am confused and kind of concerned about Ricardo Pepi, but I think Augsburg coming in and splashing that amount of cash shows their intent to get him minutes, to get him opportunities. So that makes me very happy. It also makes me very happy that Graham has happy news from Scotland.
Is this Nathan Patterson are we talking about?
Oh, I was talking about Sterling Albion.
Oh, right. I thought we'd maybe talk along transfer lines. So I'll mention that one quickly. Nathan Patterson, who is the first team right back for Scotland, appears to be on his way to Everton, which is a good move because very strangely for someone who's going for £60 million to the Premier League to be a first team player at Everton, he hasn't played much at Rangers this season because James Tavernier is the first choice right back for Rangers. So I'm excited just to see more of him, and I think it's exciting that we might have a bit of balance to our defence given that we are a team of left backs otherwise, so maybe we'll now have a right back to balance things up. Sterling Albion, we're now calling this section Host's Corner, which is an excuse basically for Ryan and I to talk about the clubs that no one else cares about. So Stirling Albion, we won a match finally. Our first one in six. I was getting a bit concerned about the way our season was going. So it was a huge win over our local rival Stennis Muir. We've got a new manager as well, Darren Young. So the table would have looked pretty ugly had we not got that win. So that was a bit of a relief. And the other thing I'm going to mention, I've been meaning to mention this for a few weeks in the section that is the host's concern segment, but in Scotland there's a bit of an interesting storyline developing with Arbroath. So Arbroath are the only part-time team in the otherwise full-time Scottish Championship, which is the second tier in Scotland, and they are currently top of the table. and they're looking good to win that title. They had a big top of the table clash against Inverness at the weekend. I streamed it online, which is the first time I've ever streamed an Arbroath match online. And it wasn't
really?
The best of matches.
I do that like every other week.
Same, Taylor and I actually get together to watch those games. So, yeah. Graham, we'll invite you now, I guess. It's kind of
it was on
now.
ESPN, I believe. On the big channel, national network.
Actually, weirdly, all three networks coordinated to all show the same game. Sort of like when you get a presidential address. It was a big one over here. It was a big one, Graham.
Yeah. No, I heard that. To be honest, I'm not even sure it was that big in Scotland. It was big in the Scottish football world. So yeah, it wasn't the best of the game, 0-0, but the fact that they're still up there and the fact that a part-time team might get promoted to the top division, which would be pure chaos, and you would have a lot of people saying that makes Scottish football look bad, but I am all on board for the chaos. So I'm a bit of a part-time Arbroath fan this season. I would like to see them get promoted.
Graham, genuine question. So if they were promoted, now they're in the top flight, does that bump from second tier to the Premiership, do you think that would be enough for them to not have to be part-time, or do you think there would still be like players playing at that professional level who are then also still doing side jobs?
So this is such an unknown that I don't really know, and I've asked other like Scottish football fans, what would happen? What happens if Arbroath get promoted to the top division? Because it's never even come close to happening. You know, the part-time teams in the Championship, there's normally one or two every season. There's two part-time teams. They normally go straight back down. They're normally sinking stones. Stirling Albion have been that team. We've been a part-time team in the Championship and we finished bottom with about 10 points over the whole season. So I don't know. The going from part-time to full-time in Scottish football is quite an undertaking, and I would expect it would take more than a summer to pull that off. So it might be the case that they employ some full-time players if they go into the top flight, but I would be surprised if they were able to get that whole squad, because all these guys have jobs, you know, they all have jobs to get out of. It's very difficult for them to get out of any contracts they have with, you know, if they're tradesmen or whatever, policemen, you know, the usual candlestick maker, all that sort of thing that gets rolled out when you're talking about FA Cup matches against part-time teams. So yeah, I don't know is the truth of the matter. And the other thing is the stadium they play at is this sort of ramshackle stadium with very few seats. It barely has a stand. It has about 500 seats. It is right on the North Sea. When you kick a ball over one of the stands, it goes in the sea, which is unusual for a top flight team to have that sort of stadium. So yeah, that's why it would be completely chaotic, and I want to see it happen.
This feels like if they were going to go back and reboot Ted Lasso, this feels like a sort of narrative story for a season, is the semi-pro team making it to the top flight under the management of Ted Lasso, and then you do have the part-timers helping out. There's always a plumber in there, and I like the idea of the plumber then fixing things around the stadium to get them ready for the Premiership season. There's usually some sort of a Lyft driver or a taxi driver, so maybe you could have like that person being the team chauffeur. It could all work out. They could find a way to make it work, I think, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, an electrician, and then the floodlights go off, and the electrician has to go off and fix the floodlights. Yeah, it's all the cliches.
All right, well, when that happens, we're going to sue them for a producer's credit. But until it does, I think we've talked about plenty from this past weekend. Joe Lowry, anything else to add from you, who I'm assuming will then be taking a nap and getting caught up on some sleep?
Yes to the nap, no to anything else to add, Taylor.
Well, thank you very much for your efforts, and thank you for being here. Good to talk to you, Arizona Joe.
Oh, thanks, Taylor. Right back at you.
And Scottish Graham, always good to talk to you as well, my friend.
Thank you, Taylor Rockwell.
Listeners, thank you all so much for listening. We'll talk to you all again very soon.